I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show. Tonight, we're going to speak with Sally Copenberg, owner of a Red Beet restaurant in Palmer, just between Palmer and Wasilla, off the Palmer-Wasilla Highway. She is on the leading edge. She and her husband, Jay, are on the leading edge of bringing the real food revolution into restaurant dining. And we're so lucky to have her out here in the valley doing what she's doing. Red Beet is an Alaskan bistro dedicated to serving real food to real people. Their food is gluten, soy, and chemical-free. They grow and harvest much of their own produce, and much of the remainder comes from local farms. Summer mornings, you'll find them out, their staff out in the farms and or in their own fields, just choosing, harvesting, and picking for the day's menu. So there's no processed foods used in their kitchen or their bakery. All foods are made with raw ingredients. Most are organic. From dairy to wild harvest to house-made, they plan their menus carefully around available local and organic foods to both nurture and delight.
So before we introduce Sally, I just want to read a little bit off of their website about what why the Bistro Red Beet exists. And off the website it says, Bistro Red Beet exists to provide real food to real people. We embrace full whole food with all of its idiosyncrasies, variety, and seasonality. We are unapologetic about what real food is and the ever-changing menu it creates. We believe in a revolution of real food. We believe that real food is sustainable food. We believe in flavor, texture, and taste without chemical or man-made additives. We believe in partnership between man and earth, that earth is living and that we must sustain it so it can sustain us. We believe in the healing power of the table. We believe in diversity. We believe that food should be fun, beautiful, and nourishing. And we believe that food should nourish both our bodies and our souls. So we're going to get into some of these topics with Sally this evening. But first, we want to introduce Sally to everyone. And Sally, if you could talk a little bit about how you came to start the Red Beet, what your history is in the Valley, what other businesses you've owned, just kind of give us a general overview of who you are, what you're doing here, what the restaurant's about, all that kind of good stuff.
Okay. Thanks, you guys. I actually was born in Palmer. So I'm a Palmerite, if you will. I'm an Alaskan native. I was raised by a very health-conscious mother and father. We lived off of wild meat and homegrown vegetables when I was young. So food has always been a very important part of who I am. I had, for 20 years, we owned Stonehill Gardens here in Palmer, so we grew much of our own produce and stuff through that just for home, and then also once we opened the beet. We opened the beet in 2007 in December of that year, and subsequently have relocated from Palmer to the Palmer-Wasilla Highway 3 years ago. We have enjoyed that location and that move. I think that for me, just food is just the basic first element of life. If you can't have good food, you cannot live a full life. You can't have food, you can't live at all. But obviously, to have a well-fulfilled and healthy life, you need to have a good, nourishing food base. And even though we are one of the richest countries in the world, we do not have a good food base. Our food base has been degraded consistently over the years, and the basic American diet these days is really does not contain food. It contains a lot of processed stuff that tastes good to the palate. The tongue enjoys it. It might make you feel great for a little while. It doesn't do very much for you. And in fact, the more and more studies are, as they progress, people are, the scientific community is realizing that the food that our country is eating is actually killing us. It's giving us all of the diseases of wealth and leisure. It's not doing all the things that I think food should do.
Well, that's what we see in our acupuncture practice on a day-to-day basis, is that, the primary issue with people is often that they don't know how to eat. Mm-hmm. And our whole attitude around food needs to change in this country, from how the food is grown, how the food is processed, how the food gets to our table, how we even eat and enjoy our food is so different in this country than, in European countries, where families actually still sit down to dinner and there's this understanding that food takes time to prepare. I think that we've got in this mindset that everything should be quick and fast and taste a particular way, and our whole attitude towards food is just a sort of utilitarian in a way. It's not thinking on terms of, it's beyond not even thinking about nourishment. I mean, there's some, we're going to get into some aspects of nourishment that are beyond just what the vitamin and mineral and carbohydrate and protein content are of the food, but just sitting down and actually enjoying a meal. I mean, I'd ask our listeners out there who are tuning in right now to think, when was the last time you just sat down with a bunch of people and really enjoyed a meal? I mean, we just don't do that anymore. Even when we go out to dinner, it's often in a rush on the way to someplace else.
Yeah, and I want to add that I think that food as entertainment becomes sort of the primacy of entertainment over nourishment. And nourishment is an afterthought, even maybe a presumption. If it tastes good and I save some money and, just presume that there's some nourishment because, why would the FDA put something in the food supply that wasn't nourishing? So there's a lot of assumptions in that, and it's all wrong. So the number one is that food first and foremost needs to be consumed for nourishment. And that doesn't preclude that it's going to be delicious, and that's obviously what you've built your entire mission around, is that it actually can be deeply nourishing and beautiful and taste good too. So maybe, you can start with just talking about how hard is it to actually do this. This is really the leading edge of restaurateuring. It's not an easy thing to do, I know.
Well, I think it's a two-edged sword. For me, it's easy, but only if I'm willing as a business owner to not be concerned about fitting a mold. If I were concerned about having a grill and deep frying things, which we do not do, if I were concerned about offering French fries, which we don't offer, if I were concerned about making sure that processed instant oatmeal is on the menu in the morning for people and their children, if I was concerned about offering what the vast majority of American restaurants offer, then it would be very difficult. But since I don't concern myself with those things, because most of those options I don't feel are really appropriate options to be eating, then that relieves me of a large level of burden that I don't have to deal with. Having said that, just finding the right foods to make a good menu is always a challenge. Recently, we've had this fantastic duck available to us, which has just dried up. So we had, for a very brief period of time, about 3 months, wonderful duck confit on the menu and some other duck items, which were great, but they're gone. And they left last week because the duck left. So those sorts of things, we now are, we've just sourced and found a really excellent source of rabbit. So maybe we can do some things with rabbit that we were doing with duck. I'm not sure. But just to use it as an example, I think that it's important to know exactly where all of the food comes from that you put on the table, whether it's a salt or a pepper or a bay leaf that's used as a seasoning, or whether it's a bean or a legume or a potato. It doesn't matter if it's fresh, if it's a dried product, because of the nature of the product, and it has to be. It really is important to know which piece of ground it came from, to know what was in the ground that it came from, if it's a vegetable, to know how it was handled when it was pulled out of the ground, to know if something was not applied to it, if so, why. Those kinds of things will actually become the food that you eat. It isn't just, I'll use a beet. I like beets, obviously. It's not just a beet. It's everything that went into that beet from before the seed was harvested and planted to the time that it's put on the table that makes that either a food or a non-food item. Just because it looks like a beet does not mean that it has all the nutritional value a beet should have. and that it has all the sustainability that that wonderful root crop should have.
So can you take us through maybe two different foods that, you know, and just walk us through that whole process with some, maybe just pick a food that's in your restaurant right now and pick a food that you would maybe start to walk through that process and find out, oh, you know, actually we can't use this because of this mm-hmm. particular reason.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So some of the vendors
you've worked with, and how
you vet them out.
Sure. I think that there's just a lot. Before I walk you through something specific, I'll tell you some of the big pitfalls that we have to pre-screen. Some of them are organic versus organically grown versus naturally grown versus those sorts of terms. And the that's part of it. You have to couple or layer on top of that the location. For example, in there's two major organic sort of monitoring groups in the lower part of the country, in the lower states, and they have different levels of allowability for contaminants in the ground that an organic product is grown in. I find that many of our Alaska-grown crops, though they are not certified organic, are cleaner and healthier and have come from better, cleaner, more virgin soil than many of the things that are labeled organic that come from other communities where many very dangerous types of chemicals were allowed in that soil up to even 20 years before the product is grown. Well, 20 years we know is not long enough to get many of these things out of the soil, even though our USDA says that it is, and even though our Food Administration allows it, they're finding that traces of that stuff is still in the food that's grown there. So
a couple questions on that. So yeah. what accounts for, is that just because this stuff wasn't used in Alaska 20 years ago, or just because people weren't growing food the way they are now? Like, what's the reason for
kind
that?
Kind of yeah. both.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Alaskan has been uniquely protected against many things that chemicals are used for. We have a very, very low insect concern and infestation in our crops. Partly that's because of our distance from other crops of similar species. Partly it's because of our cold winters. Partly it's because of our lack of agriculture. We just have a less dense agricultural base, so there's less chance of things moving around from space to space. So that is changing. Our climate is getting warmer up here. The things that we can grow are getting warmer. Our imports are getting more massive. So with boxes of apples that come in things that aren't good, with boxes of potatoes, with boxes of corn, with fresh house plants. There's a lot of insects that are now being introduced mm-hmm. that were not there before, and some of them are becoming somewhat problematic. So that is changing. But I still find that a potato grown in Alaskan soil, which is, even though it maybe has been lightly fertilized with a chemical of some sort, say a phosphorus-based chemical, depending on what that chemical is, of course, I find that one phosphorus-based chemical is possibly less dangerous than something grown in an organic soil, perhaps in an organic method, with neighboring farms that are spraying, having backwash on it. Most potatoes are grown in very tight neighborhoods of other farmers and other potatoes. So potatoes these days are a good example, because we have a lot of them in Alaska, because on a standard potato farm in a different climate than ours, they often spray them to sprout them. So that's the first chemical, after they've sprayed them in the fall to preserve them through the winter so that they can spray them to sprout them in the spring.
And this is common practice
in
Alaska?
This does not happen in Alaska.
Okay.
No, this is in another community. Okay. They will spray them to help mature them faster. They will spray them to make the vines die. They will sometimes in between the maturity and the vine killing, they will spray them to get an extra blossom on them. Once they're harvested, they often clean them with a chemical, and then they put a sprout inhibitor on them, then they store them, and then when they send them to the store, they will spray them again with another
Wow.
sprout inhibitor. There are many, many levels of spraying and chemicals added to these potatoes. Well, some of those are done in the field, and some of them are actually cross-contaminating.
So even if you're growing organic, quote, organic potatoes on your farm, if you're surrounded by farms that are doing this practice, it's almost impossible to not get cross-contamination.
It is. And then there's soil leaching because of climate, you know, because of weather. There's also whatever happened in that soil in the past.
Right.
And they just don't allow enough time for the soil to become clean. So in Alaska, most potatoes, most farmers that I know that grow potatoes in a standard non-organic fashion will put an organic fertilizer on their potato. That is all a non-organic fertilizer or an organic, depending on who they are. That's all they put on their potatoes.
Wow, sign me up. Sounds much better.
So that is a much healthier potato. And sometimes they will have to put a sprout inhibitor on them when they sell them. It depends on where they go to, what their market is, if it's the military or some of the larger
And the sprout inhibitors, do you know what kinds of chemicals those are?
Like, I don't know what they're currently using. I do not know.
Okay, but it's something that inhibits growth. So
it does.
It's probably not good.
It's a growth hormone inhibitor.
Right.
Sally, I've got a question. I wanted to ask, how much confidence can we have in produce that's coming from out of country that says organic, like organic apples from Chile or organic grapes from Chile? I mean, is that really
we need to take a picture right now of the face that Sally's making, the grimaces that are, coming off of
it. I really like what you're saying about this, because there are some times when I'll buy organic produce and I feel terrible afterwards. And I'm like, that, you know, it says organic, but I'm not convinced that this is actually a healthy product. So what do you think?
Well, and that's something we balance constantly. Do we buy it just because it says organic, or do we not trust that label and go back and source? And I never trust the label. I just have grown to know that I can't. Answering your question about things grown in other countries, I've traveled an enormous amount, and I travel. When I travel, I look at farms. I eat local food if I can, and I go to farms. I visit food processing plants. I look at how coffee is dried and fermented, or tea is dried and fermented, depending on what is a natural crop in those communities. I talk to the farmers. I find out what their seed sources are, if they're genetically modified, if they're bioengineered, what the deal is with their food. Because food is a universal component, and the smaller our world gets, the more food passes from country to country. And I know some of the worst examples, I think, of organic farms out of the country that I've seen were in Mexico, where they were growing tomato crops and they were using human waste as part of their allowed organic fertilizer. And the tomatoes rested in soil that was saturated in human waste.
And I'm guessing it wasn't twice composted human waste like they do here.
When people raw.
I know that people do use human waste, but they do a double composting kind of thing with it.
So like a compost toilet.
Yeah. But not commercially.
No.
It's not.
I mean, I know that it's done up here, but it's not done. It's not like right out of the composting toilet onto the crops. It's composting toilet, and then it's like secondary composting.
Right, and this was made into a slush, a very unattractive smelling slush. And then it was utilized like a tea almost, or, you know, kind of a slushy tea.
Yeah.
And it wasn't very attractive, and it didn't smell good. And I really felt bad for the workers. I would not want to have work in that.
And I
bring
organic?
That up simply because, because it was a natural form of fertilizer. So it was allowed.
Wow.
This was not all that many years ago. Now, whether those practices have changed there, I don't know. But you do see a lot of interesting type of alternative fertilizer products, because some of the more safe ones tend to be harder to mine. They maybe are harder to get to, so therefore they're a little bit more expensive. When you abound in human waste, I think it would be very tempting to do that. However, I'm not going to go there. I'm not a physician, but it is pretty much a known fact that there are a lot of health risks involved in that. And that would some. So I don't buy organic tomatoes from Mexico. It's just not on my priority list.
Right.
But then that brings in another aspect. The tomato industry in the United States is unfortunately well known for its lack of humanity, for how poorly it treats its workers, for actually just taking advantage and hiring and dismissing people. For actually harming, and people are actually killed, not by their employers so much, but bringing people in illegally in so containers and so not
big,
treating them, taking
trafficking
care of them.
In illegal immigrants to come in and pick the tomatoes, yes. And then trying to deport mm-hmm. them back across the country and then mm-hmm. do it again to
over
save money.
And over.
Yeah.
And it's not that's not a clean industry.
No.
I don't care how organic their practice, if that's what they're doing with the human part of that industry, that is not a clean yeah. source that I could use.
That's not sustainably sourced.
No, it is not.
Yeah.
No. So those are the kinds of things that we have to look for. And I tell you, there's like a trap at every door because I think, oh, this is great. Okay, they use this passes, this inspection passes. And then I think, oh, my gosh, people were harmed in the making of this product. I can't sell this product because that's just not right.
Right.
I mean, it's just ethically wrong to do that.
Yeah, so now I'm thinking about like how, I mean, first of all, it's eye-opening for, you know, anybody who's ever read an organic label and felt really proud of themselves for picking the more expensive organic celery, because I have my Dirty Dozen and my Clean 15 list,
right,
and it says
exactly.
that celery is one of the most, you know, highly pesticided mm-hmm. crops out there, so I'm mm-hmm. going to buy my organic celery because mm-hmm. I know that that's one that I'm much safer. But then what does that label really mean? And so you mm-hmm. just, you know, pulled out 5-10 different things that now we have to go and ask, well, what is really behind this organic mm-hmm. label? So how do you go about doing that?
Oh, my. As I said, we do try to get around a lot and visit farms and see what they have to say. We read and we research a lot, obviously. At some point, we have to finally start to trust what we know. But that comes, I think, with a lot of years of experience, too. So you kind of know how to read between those lines. There are some phrases that are tossed around that you just know not to trust.
For example?
Organically certified. Honestly, I just don't like that phrase.
Naturally grown. Like, that means nothing.
Naturally right? grown uh-huh. is just a bag of hot air. It means nothing. It means it was grown naturally. Well, huh. I mean, pretty much everything has to grow in nature, whether we've manipulated the nature or not.
Right.
It still grows in some form of dirt or water. So, yeah, that's not too terribly definitive. I think organically grown practices is actually a very positive phrase, because most people who've adopted that, from my experience, are people who, for whatever reason, cannot find their way through time or expense to have their farm, whether it be a vegetable or a meat-producing or an egg-producing farm or whatever, become certified, organically certified. That is a very expensive process, and sometimes it doesn't, for all the reasons we've been discussing, it doesn't necessarily hold as much authority as it could. So many people are going away from that need or that feeling, that urge to be certified organically, and they're simply adopting good, wholesome, organically grown practices. So when I see that, I look into that a little bit more seriously, and I say, so what are your practices? What do you do?
So I know Sierra and River Bean, who own mm-hmm. Arctic Organics, that mm-hmm. they do that. I think at one point they may have had the organic certification, but they had talked about right. that. Just it got more and more expensive every year, and their produce is so much of a higher level anyway mm-hmm. than what's considered the base organic standard. So they mm-hmm. they dropped trying to do that because of the expense mm-hmm. and just mm-hmm. went towards more what you're talking about. So let's talk about what some of those practices yeah. are when people are.
Yeah, and before ahead. We yeah. do that, I just want to invite our listeners, if you have a question for Sally. We're speaking to Sally Kopenberg, owner of the Bistro Red Beet, and we're talking about the real food revolution in the restaurant setting and also as it applies to being a smart consumer. If you have questions, just type them into our Facebook page, Bridge to Everywhere on Facebook, and we'll ask Sally on the air.
So I'd like to talk about back to those practices that mm-hmm. would be, you know, grown according to organic practices. Mm-hmm. And then also you mentioned there were two certifying bodies in the U.S. And is there one that you trust more than the other, and what it really means to
right.
be certified organic?
Well, and we could probably talk about organic all for the whole hour, but
sure.
I think that's only just a tiny piece
yep.
of this of what we're actually mm-hmm. Talking about too. I think that not to answer that question too directly, but at the restaurant, we don't really say we're an organic restaurant, because we're not. I mean, we have organically grown product. We have organically certified product. We have just well-grown, wholesome product that and we're always balancing. So I think that to look at who certified it, and there's the Oregon Health, which is one of the and I think that they actually do a pretty good job of what they do. They try very hard. But again, going back to what we said before, they're working with an already contaminated world. They're trying to fit an organic into an already contaminated world. I went to my undergraduate school at Willamette University. I was one of the first people in our country to get a degree in environmental science because that was the only place you could get one at the time. And I was I told them I wanted to grow up. Have a garden on campus, and they just looked at me like I was wacko. And I said, no, I want to have a garden because, you know, this was many years ago. This was in the 70s, in the early 70s, and I didn't like the food on campus. It didn't taste all that pleasing to me, and it was kind of greasy and kind of heavy and had a lot of pasta in it. So they said, oh, finally, after great long discussions, they allowed me to have a garden. So I had like the first organic garden on campus, and it was fun. But people didn't quite understand what I was doing because organics were becoming important to people. The older generation didn't understand it because they kind of felt like it was what they had already done. The newer generation had gone through the 50s and the 60s when TV dinners were introduced, and fast
Tang.
Food.
Don't forget
and Tang.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Take you all the way to the moon and back. And they had lost sight of a lot of that, and the convenience had taken over any rational need for real food. So there was this, I was kind of plunked in a void in between these two things. And I had the Oregon Health come by that was in their very, very baby years and tell me what an organic garden was. And they told me this. They said, you have to grow it in virgin soil. And they've gotten away from that now because there's not enough virgin soil left. And
what is virgin soil?
Soil that's never been, that nothing has ever been grown in and that has not been contaminated by a parking lot or by a car parking over it and dripping oil on it or by a construction site. It would really be a natural meadow, perhaps, something from a woods where you cut some trees down.
I'm thinking we're going into the backcountry and hiking some mountains to find a little plot of land where nothing's
so grown. I had an organic garden, but it wasn't, according to Hoyle, because it had been planted in grass for lots of years. So I stripped all the grass out, and then I did some scrubbers. I put a bunch of earthworms in there. I put a whole bunch of little critters in there that would clean and scrub the soil, and then I planted it the next year. But it didn't qualify. And then I just wanted to grow with organic growing practices. Mm-hmm. I wanted to use, you know, my natural green sand phosphoruses, and I wanted to, you know, make tea baths for my plants, and I just wanted to nurture them and see where they would grow and what they would do, and then I wanted to eat them. And so I did.
That's awesome.
That's great.
So that's what I did. And it was sort of an anomaly. People just walked by and they thought it was really weird. We had a little sign on it that said we kind of had it tied into one of the biology classes. And
well that just
fun.
Shows how disconnected we've gotten. As I know, I've heard stories about
it's
people
true.
Who, yeah, you know, friends of patients or, you know, family members where, well, my sister won't eat anything that doesn't come from the supermarket in a plastic wrapped pre-sliced package, you know, and that to them is clean. But the idea of taking a carrot out of the garden where it's got a little dirt on it that you have to shake the dirt off and, like, you know, maybe rinse it or something and, you know, it's still got the leaves attached to it, like, that's actually frightening in some ways for people.
I think it is.
Yeah.
It is. I worked on farms when I was young, and at lunch hour, that's what we'd do. We'd walk up and down the rows and go, ooh, that cabbage looks really great, and we'd chop that cabbage off and eat it for lunch or bite into a big head of lettuce. There's nothing better than a head of lettuce that's just right. That you just plucked.
Well, it seems like this real food movement has, you are definitely ahead of your time, and it seems like this movement is well underway. It seems like it's you're really hitting a stride. And I'm curious, do you feel like this market here in Alaska is responding? Does it seem like there's a real interest? How could this actually catch fire in the restaurant business up here, in the restaurant industry? Or is it really going to take some time for that to be practical from an economic standpoint?
I think if it had economic benefits, it would be there already. We make a living that way, but it's not the easiest living it could be. Every once in a while, my husband just throws his arms up and says, let's just feed them hot dogs and deep fried food. We'll just be rich and we can go on vacation. Well, you know, he probably has a point, because a hot dog costs pennies to purchase and you sell it for a buck.
Okay, but we're just down to the last seconds here before we take a break. Stay with us. We're speaking with Sally Kopenberg of the Bistro Red Beet. Come stay with us just for a few minutes.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, KVRF 89.5 on your FM dial. If you'd like to get involved with community radio, contact us at radiofreepalmer.org. This is your chance to invent community radio in Sutton, Chickaloon, Butte, Palmer, and the surrounding areas.
Hi, welcome back, everyone. You're listening to The Bridge to Everywhere, and we're interviewing Sally Kopenberg of Bistro Red Beet, and we're talking about sustainably sourced foods and how to actually run a restaurant based on the foods that are seasonably available, the foods that are actually healthy, that are used sustainable, even beyond organic types of growing practices. And we were just having a discussion about the difficulties of actually doing that, like what it requires if you're going to run a restaurant and have a business that supports itself and supports the people who are running the business. And so we want to get a sense from you, Sally, like how much time this actually takes and also what this changes for the bottom line, because I know one of the issues when you're running a restaurant is people are very cost conscious. Mm-hmm. You know, in this country, mm-hmm. we're not so likely to want to spend money on food. That's part of the issue, is we want mm-hmm. our food cheap and we want it fast. And so when you're going to a restaurant like yours, you know, there's going to be a premium to pay for what you're doing. All that work that you just did, all that knowledge that you have is going mm-hmm. into the food, and people are paying you for that when they're buying food at your restaurant. So mm-hmm. we just want to talk a little bit about that. You know, how does that transfer to the bottom line, and what you have to charge for dinner, and how much does it transfer to the bottom line of your actual time? You know, do you have free time when you do this?
Well, it transfers to several things. It transfers to time. It transfers to money. It also speaks to something that Kevin asked earlier, which was, how's it going in Alaska on this front? I can answer that pretty easily by saying this. If we were in San Francisco, we could charge twice what we charge for our food, and we would have lines out the door. We can't do that here. People are wary. There is a really great, solid clientele that come to our restaurant that are happy there. But it is still, I think the vast population in our state is still into a totally different kind of food. It's the quick, fast, stack them up high, burger made out of soy.
For $10.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the irony is we've done some tests ourselves. We've gone to, and I won't say where, but we've gone to a couple of the really most popular fast food places. We've bought a money equivalent amount of food. We've taken it back. We've weighed it. We've analyzed how many carbs are in it. We've looked at how much fat is in it. We've actually, I haven't, but bless my husband, he's eaten it. And we've compared, do you feel like you're done eating now that you've eaten this versus do you feel like you're done eating when you eat one of our meals, and how much protein is in it? And we've compared them, and there really is no comparison. The meals we've compared over the last several years have been very, very high in carbohydrates, high in fat, and high in filler food, which is soy and corn primarily. Very low in protein, low in nutrients, and low in the area of satisfaction. So once the meal was done, there felt like there was a need to keep eating. And I think that's where our obesity mm-hmm. in our country comes from to a great extent.
Because the food that we're eating.
Yes, it is. Of course. And we have a very low rate of dessert sales. And people say, oh, I really want to buy a piece of that cake, but I can't hold any more food. I'm very happy. And our meals are not overwhelming in size, but they're solid, concentrated nutrition and taste and flavor. And that's what we need to eat. That's all we need. We don't need to go overboard. So I think that whole concept, though, is once you've embraced it, you're happy with it. But there's a vast number of people out there who have not embraced the fact that we need to change the way we eat. And
what do you think it's going to take for that? Because I know that this is something that we are really fighting a bit of a battle
with, because it's we've had so many people on this show now over the past year and a half. We had Francois Vecchio, the poet of pork. We talked about artisanal, you know, meat production, and we've had Stella Lynn on the show a couple times, and she's talked about herbs and food, and we've had Mary Sarah Stanton, who's talked about, you know, about food. We've had so many different Julie Allie Barker, you know, I mean, on and on. The list goes on. Ellie Vandevist. I mean, a lot of what we talk about is gardening and growing and food and all the different. I mean, it's like, you know, trying to open that up, and yet it seems like the cultural direction is still we want more and we want it fast and we want it cheap. And and you know, after listening to everybody talk over the past year and a half, it's just really made me think, like, okay, so we know that this is an issue. Any thoughts on how to get it to change other than just doing what you're doing and just giving people the opportunity to try it and see if they like it, and if they do it, then they'll come back for more?
Yeah, exactly. One hopes, yes. Yeah. But I think that the word revolution is really, truly a very good word to apply to this, because any good revolution starts slow and takes people who are pretty ballsy, have a lot of tenacity, who don't really care what other people think about them, who really believe in the cause. Whether it's a good cause or a bad cause, that's not the point. The point is they just feel this is the only calling for them, the only way to go, the only thing to do in life, and they do it. And I think that, like anything, if we really want vast changes, we just need more people that are willing to do that and to make that stand. And if that means that, speaking back to financial rewards, if that means that our profit margin is lower than it could be if we sold junk food, then so be it. Our profit margin will simply be lower, because it means that we can sleep at night. We're very comfortable with what we do. We're very comfortable with what we give to people. I am horrified at the thought that I would put something on a plate and serve it to someone and it would make them ill, whether they knew they were ill or not. That just terrifies me, that
very thought.
Well,
that's the type of restaurant that I want to go to, that somebody feels that way. And one of our acupuncture teachers, her name's Nikki Bilton, my favorite line from her is, if you're willing to pay the price, there is no price. You know, and what that, to me, that means, like, if you're that passionate about it, you're willing to pay that price, then ultimately you're fulfilling what you're here to do. You know, you're fulfilling your destiny, and that's just part of what you have to do. There's no other way to do it anyway.
Like, this is just a lifestyle. It's not something. I don't go to work and go home. I work all the time in my mind. I'm working all the time. I'm thinking about whatever it is that I need to do next. Oh, my gosh, I have no duck. What am I going to do? Well, that's not a panic, but what could I do instead? Or I have a holiday coming up. How am I going to make something that's beautiful, attractive, that mothers will love, because Mother's Day is coming up, that people will want to treat their mothers to, but that will satisfy all of my criteria, because my criteria are fairly, fairly extensive.
Yeah, and I love your aesthetic. I mean, you have such a fine taste of beauty for beauty, and it comes through in your food preparation. It comes through in your restaurant decor. And
when you cater stuff, I mean, you can see it. It's just so much care taken in the food. You know,
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just really clear. It's different from, you know, there's so many different places you can order stuff from and get things catered, or you can just go get a platter of food from Cars or Costco, and it's just such a different experience when the beat caters something.
Yeah, and I want to add to that. You know, years ago I worked for General Mills in their new restaurant development division, and they have since spun that company off as Darden Restaurants. They have Olive Garden, Red Lobster, and I was joining them for a third concept they were working from the ground up called China Coast, and it was like a precursor to P.F. Chang's. And right out of college, it was my first real corporate work experience building a restaurant concept from scratch. And one of the things that blew me away was how methodical. This is just absolute numbers. It is... you know, from the moment a person walks in the door, they know how much that person's going to cost them. The free chopsticks, the free fortune cookies, the free buns, deep fried buns they would give them, all the freebies. And then everything is measured to the T. They have this so mapped out in terms of what's, you know, how much the cost per customer is. Things that they would do to extend product life is you know, terrible, but legal. And I have to say, they had incredible clean kitchens. Everything was done to the T. But, you know, sugar and salt and fat and the oils, the deep fryer, they'd have to pour in a chemical to extend the life of the deep fryer oil. And, you know, on and on it goes. And you're getting chemical exposure, things to keep the, you know, the food actually tasting good. But this is about, you know, a business model that has outlived its relevance. It's no longer, it's hurting people more than it's mm-hmm. helping people. Mm-hmm. And there's a book by John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods mm-hmm. chain, called Conscious Capitalism. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of what you're talking about, mm-hmm. which is really changing the motive for business. Mm-hmm. And that in its own turn is going to change, local level, mm-hmm. but also on the national level.
I think so. I think as long as enough people get on board so that it can spread farther, you know, so that the fingers can go out into the community, because it is a very different model. I, too, know how much my freebies are going to be for my customers. I know how much it costs to wash a napkin. We have these beautiful blue napkins, and I know how much it costs for every napkin I wash, every time I wash a napkin. I have to know that. Otherwise, I it's part of my success or lack of success. You have to know these things, but you have to do things the way that you believe they need to be done and how they have to be done. And rather than pouring chemicals in to extend life, we do it differently. You know, we do many small amounts of things over and over and over and over to keep them absolutely fresh. We don't prep food at all. So there is no prepping happening in our kitchen. I can wander in 20 minutes before we open, and I'm good to go because we don't prep. It's the only thing we do. We slow roast our meats overnight in our oven, in our big stone oven for our slow roasted meat sandwiches. Everything, you know, I make my fresh pickles. I make fresh spiced apples that we use here and there, but our sauces, our dressings, everything is made essentially as we serve it. If we get an order for a bistro salad, that means I have to quick whip up a little cup of fresh, blue cheese dressing.
So that's amazing to me because Kevin and I both worked at the Glacier Brew House uh-huh. in the late 90s, and mm-hmm. we also worked at the Hilton. And it's all about the prep cooks. The early shift during the day is, people come in at 9 o'clock and they're chopping and prepping. Yep. And then by the time the servers mm-hmm. come in the evening mm-hmm. and, dinners are starting to right. roll, there's lines of these big metal containers yep. and they have, cucumbers in it, or they mm-hmm. have carrots, or they mm-hmm. have, pre-made dressings, mm-hmm. or they have chopped, mm-hmm. Grapes, and they have, mm-hmm. or they have, walnuts in them, or, that mm-hmm. have been, sugared and roasted or whatever, right. There's just a line of 20, 30, 40, 50 yep. different items and mm-hmm. sauces that are pre-made. And those things themselves often are made with pre-made items like garlic.
Correct.
For instance, nobody was peeling garlic in the, right. in the kitchen. They came in these gallon jars that
all
were
all pre-peeled.
Yeah. Pre-peeled garlic. If you were lucky.
And therefore lacking flavor.
Right.
Yes.
Or even worse, at least at the brew house, they were using those pre-peeled garlic, but it was like a whole piece of garlic. Some places use the pre-chopped garlic in oil, which is even worse.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
Right.
And it's rancid and strong tasting. Yeah. It's not good. Well, and that if you ordered a salad, for example, from us, the salad is taken from the head, cleaned and put on the plate. The beet is cut and chopped and put on the salad. The pepper is cut and chopped and put on the salad. The onion is cut and chopped and put on the salad. And until it's cut and chopped and put on your salad, it's in its whole form. Mm-hmm. And it's as close to being harvested as we can get it in the winter. That changes clearly. And then we use lots of root crops, but we store them exceptionally well, obviously. But in the summer, we really like to harvest for every day if we can, and there's nothing that tastes better than something that's only been harvested within hours of eating it. And that is very labor intensive. So it affects the number of hours we can be open, that I feel we can viably be open. We're open 10:30 till 3:30, which is a 5-hour window. And 5 hours, it sometimes that 5 hours for us is effectively 10 hours because we're harvesting before we get there. We're quickly and crazily cleaning the butts of that lettuce so that it'll be clean for our storage until we can get it on your plate and then clean it again. After the meal, we're often go to the fields and we'll scout where we're going to go in the morning so we know what we're going to get. Or maybe we have to go and get and pick up something that we don't grow. So we have to go to a source and pick up a dairy, or we have to pick up a an organic sugar or something like that. So we, because we buy from so many sources, we buy from all over the place. And some, a lot of places we go and we'll buy one item there. And then we'll go someplace and we'll buy one item. And then we'll go to a farm and we'll buy two items. And go to another farm and buy two more items. Or we are really fortunate. We have some relationships where they will deliver them to us in the morning. That's pretty fantastic. But we don't ask people to do that. Because if they're only growing one item, if all they're growing for us is bok choy, then I just feel that I'm taking advantage of that grower to say, I will buy your bok choy, but you must bring it to my doorstep. No, I'll go get it from you. If it's what I need and what I want, I'll make the time. Having said that, however, part of the joy of preparing food and serving good food to people is the procuring of the food. My dream job would be to not cook, to simply procure excellent food. I love it. I love to get it. I love to look at it. I like to evaluate it. I like to research it. I like to touch it and feel it. I would love to be able to be in a position where I could do that and then hand it over to a talented chef and say, now you get to do the rest of it.
Do you know anything about the restaurant Favakan in, I think it's in Sweden. Is it Sweden? I was just looking it up.
I think it is.
I only know it by reputation.
Norway. Yeah. I mean, they do something similar to what you're doing. And to make it even more complicated, you can only get there. I think you have to take a special flight to get there. And you have to stay overnight at the restaurant. Yeah. And they have three seasons. They have their spring season where they're actually growing things. And, well, it's probably late spring where they're growing things and they're serving people things from their garden. And then they have there's a harvest season. There's a, like, they preserve stuff over the year. And then they have their sort of like mid-season where they're not they're just everything that's been canned or jarred or fermented that they're serving and I would love to get the two of you guys to you together with that chef from that restaurant
and eventually I would like to pinch out and squeeze out everything that's not grown here in this valley, but we can't do that quite yet and still financially survive. We just can't. I mean, we know that. We still have to import a few items. We still have to bring some things in. We have a couple of really great partners in Washington and Oregon, and we still bring some stuff in from them.
And that brings me to what you were saying. So sometimes you work hard to find a source of something, and you were saying, was it corn-free
baking powder?
Mm. Yeah, and then you lose that source, and then you have to go find another source, and that's pretty devastating. What happens to all of the stuff that you're carrying?
You just in the meantime?
Yeah.
You have to not be afraid to be creative, to tell somebody we're not doing that right now. you have to be willing to be unafraid of the stereotype that when people walk in the door and they want a baked good and they want a brownie, if the brownie's not there, that they'll never come back. You just have to not be afraid of that. If that's the case, so be it. But we prefer to give our customers the benefit of the doubt and to assume that they are going to trust that we are providing them the best thing that we can do. And if the best thing we can do that day is not a brownie because we don't have a good baking powder to use in it, then we have to give that level of trust to that customer and assume that they will then trust us back. So on a really great transition, we will have enough left. We have enough before we find out we can't get another source, and then I just start, I put myself into high mode and I start looking. And I always have a little backup list of places that I haven't finished researching. Maybe I could go here, maybe I could go there, here and there.
So you're never done in a sense. You know, there's always something that you're going to you're going to be like imminently running out of, and then there's always new stuff coming online. Mm-hmm. So it's really never nothing's ever fixed. And then from your customers, basically, you want people who are kind of wandering in and going, "Huh, I wonder what the beet has today." Mm-hmm. You know, and they're coming in from that mindset as opposed to
to be fluid. We have to remain fluid, and we have to have a fluid clientele. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we do a set menu, but it's not a set menu that lasts. It changes and flows and ebbs and moves about.
Can you give us an idea what's on the menu right now?
Well, right now, you know, we always have a number of different salads and sandwiches and a couple of soups. And as long as my good local onions last, my French onion soup will stay on the menu. It's fantastic. And we've been making it with duck broth. We aren't making it with duck broth anymore. But I think it'd be fantastic made with rabbit broth. Uh-huh. I think that'd be great.
Good.
Yeah. So, or a chicken broth, because we do have a great source of nice, organic, succulent little chickens, and they make great broth. So
let me back up. So you said you're not doing prep cook. Are you cooking the broths overnight?
or when, how are you doing the broth?
Well, the broths come from our slow roasts, and then they're used immediately.
Okay.
So, I mean, that is prep in, in a sense. But when I say I don't prep, what I'm saying is that we don't pre-prepare the things that are typically pre-prepared.
Like obviously, cut vegetables 2 days in advance.
Exactly. Or even a few hours in advance. Because a green onion, for example, is just has lovely, lovely juices, and it glistens on the ends when you fresh cut it. But if you set it even an hour, it's all dried, and it's strange looking. It becomes more like a dried chive almost. And the flavor oozes out of all those little cuts, and it loses intensity. So so those are the we have to pre-cook meat. We don't serve raw meat. There you go. You know, we pre-smoke our smoked salmon, or if we buy it smoked, it's pre-smoked, clearly. You know, we harvest things from the field, and we pick berries, and we harvest wild herbs, and we use all of those things. But we don't pre-prepare things that go onto your plate.
Yeah, I was just curious about broth. Right. Like, you know, most places that, you know, even when they're making their own broth, they're doing, you know, there's a lot of kitchen scraps going in, and there's like a big pot, you know, that's happening from, you know, a day or two beforehand, and they're using that broth, and then that broth is what becomes the soup a few days later.
Right.
So there's a constant process of recycling in the kitchen of things going going on.
And we use every scrap of everything. I do not believe in waste, and I don't like waste. And if it's something that I just feel has a compromised flavor or texture or something, my dogs eat it. My dogs have a fantastic paleo diet, and they get it entirely from the restaurant. So,
Sally, what I was going to ask you is, you know, for a revolution to happen, you have to have education. So you have to educate your consumers, but you also have to inspire other entrepreneurs, people that might actually be interested in doing something similar to you, to spread the passion. Do you see niches, or, you know, for the budding entrepreneur, do you see areas in this marketplace where there's real food opportunities? And then secondly, do you have, you know, classes for folks to want to learn more?
We don't have a current class schedule. We will be putting one together. I think this year's class schedule will be in the field. I'd like to put one together for the summer, where we go out and we harvest things, or we dig and get fresh and wild herbs, because they're very important, and we use a lot of them, and they're very useful, and they're free. They're there. Everybody could use them if they knew what to get. And then center and then organize classes around that. Right now, what I see, if we have an influence, I see the influence that we might have would be on our individual clients more than anybody else, because I have great long discussions with many of my clients on these topics. Like, how do we do this at home? We both work. We're professional with three children. We run all over the place. We're going every direction with our three children for their activities and their sports. How do we find time to cook at home for them and feed them in a good way so that they're not caught in this trap that we're caught in? How do we do this so that we don't stop and buy, you know, junk food on the way home for our family because we're tired? And we have lots of discussions about that. And I will spend endless amounts of time with a client if that's what they want to do. And so we sort of do a lot of that sort of one-on-one teaching, if you will, where there's no formal arrangement. But they know what time of day to catch me. They catch me at 3:30 right when we're closing. Then there you have it. Because I just feel like I can't say to them, look, I have someplace to go. I've got to be gone. I feel like that's dishonoring their desire to make a better world for their kids and for themselves, and to make a better world for other people, and to be part of the movement of making our country change the way they eat. And if that means that that's a one-on-one influence that perhaps can urge them and encourage them to just try a little harder, you know, maybe don't be quite so tired at night, just a little bit harder. If I can encourage them to do that and make their life better, they're going to spread the word, not about what we're doing specifically, but what they're doing. They're going to spread the word and go, wow, you know, okay, so we're just eating, we've quit eating all this junk stuff. We're not eating that anymore. We're only eating whole raw vegetables that we cook ourselves, and we're only eating these cuts of meat that we do this with, and we feel so much better. You should really try this. And they'll spread the word to their family and to their friends, and then the revolution continues that way. So it a lot of it is not formal. It's not really formal education. I find that when people want classes for cooking, they don't want that as much as I would like them to. They want to know how to make a tasty French onion soup, bottom line. Well, they don't care where the onions came from. They don't necessarily care what kind of bread is on the top of it or what kind of crusts or what the... They just kind of want to go home and be able to make a really nice French onion soup and have a glass of wine and enjoy it. And that's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But that tends to be, at this point, what I'm seeing more for requests for formal cooking classes. So I'm constantly trying to reevaluate how I spend my time in that area and what it is exactly that I can do that will help people eat better. Because that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, and if you're not interested in, I mean, you know, there's plenty of places people can go. Maybe if not in Anchorage, you know, I'm sure out of state, there's 20 places in YouTube. There's probably 20 places in Seattle you can go learn how to make a tasty French. Yeah. But what you're offering is something really unique that, I mean, I don't think anybody else in this, is anybody else in the state doing what you're doing? Are there any other restaurateurs that are doing, do you have a
I'm not
network?
Fully aware of it.
Yeah.
I'm always looking, mm-hmm. but I'm not fully aware of anything like that. But people can learn to cook on YouTube.
Right.
They don't need me to learn to cook.
Right.
Sally,
go ahead.
Sorry, how serious are GMO foods? I wanted to get that before we run out of time here.
How serious are they?
Yeah,
you mean how dangerous are they?
How dangerous are they? How much of a serious
I don't know, threat? But I don't like them. I don't know, but here's why I don't trust them. I don't trust them because I've been in agriculture and horticulture most of my life, and I'm very aware of how genetic engineering alters everything about a product, everything about it. So I do know that the best examples we have with, with the Roundup Ready seeds and the Roundup Ready foods that are pretty well known these days and have a lot of research that have gone into them, that genetic modification is simply allowing us to eat more chemicals. It's just allowing the food source to absorb that rather than to be killed by it. Therefore, it's absorbing it into itself. We are then processing that, and then we are eating it and absorbing it into us. And that can't be good.
Well, and I know that another example is something called BT corn.
Yes.
Which is another
yes.
You know, that corn has a chemical in it, which when the insect eats the corn, it
yes.
actually eats away at their stomachs,
yes.
and the insect stomachs blow apart. And mm-hmm. initially, I'm sure it was, I think it's Monsanto, but
yeah.
I can't remember. I'm pretty sure it's Monsanto. They said, oh, no, this doesn't affect humans. And then come to
right.
find out that this is affecting human digestive
yes.
systems.
And there were scientists yeah. who were researching this
yes.
who actually did find this before the product was released and sanctioned by the FDA.
Yes.
It was just research that was then
sort of buried away.
Buried. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the mm-hmm. idea that that these things don't combine, I know at one point I was listening to an NPR broadcast, and it was having to do with it was walruses and the health of walrus populations,
mm-hmm.
and it was talking about walruses getting viruses. And the researchers were talking, and they said something about the mutations of the virus getting into the walruses' cells and then affecting
mm-hmm.
their DNA. And
mm-hmm.
I was like, huh, that's really interesting. Here they're talking about it in animal populations,
mm-hmm.
but for some
mm-hmm.
reason nobody thinks it happens with humans
right.
when we're eating genetically
yeah.
modified food. Like, how is this food
yeah.
interacting with our genes?
Well, and I think that at the bottom of this all, we forget we're an animal. We are an animal. We are no different mm-hmm. than the walruses. We're no different than the penguins. We're no different than the creatures that we see this affecting. But we like to think we're different.
Mm-hmm.
We like to think we're superior and that this is not going to hurt us. And it's not true.
Oh, so we have one more minute left. So
okay.
we just want to let everyone know. So we're talking to Sally Copenberg, owner of Red Beet Bistro. If you could just let everyone know, again, where the bistro is, what the hours of operation are, and if they want to call you and get more information
on
the website.
Yeah.
Okay. So the website is bistroredbeet.com. You can email as well. It's redbeet@mtaonline.net. We welcome questions. We are on the Palmer-Wasilla Highway, right at Shenham Drive. And the Palmer-Wasilla, we're actually on a frontage road right next to it, so you have to kind of get to us that way. We are open 10:30 till 3:30, Tuesday through Friday, and Saturday 10 till 5.
And you have a summer concert series.
We have a summer concert series starting next Thursday night. We have five fantastic musicians, and we have a Beat Fest also. That's going to be a Radio Free Palmer fundraiser, and that's going to be on the 25th of July.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Sally, for joining us, and thanks, everyone,
You're welcome.
For listening
thank
this
you.
Evening. Have a great evening.
Have a good night. Thanks, Sally.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.